Content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine, the best of the U.S. and international media. The Triangle Radio Reading Service would like to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are reading this week from the March 31st, 2017 issue of the Week magazine. This week, the cover shows a cartoon type drawing of Antonin Scalia holding a judge's chair. He's in his robe, and Neil Gorsuch, the nominee, is about to sit down in the chair, and they're both smiling and looking fondly at each other. And then off to the side, in just a regular business suit, Merrick Garland, the nominee who did not get a hearing last year. And the title says, Musical Chairs. Should Gorsuch get the Scalia seat denied to Garland? And with that, we will go right into the main stories and how they were covered. Gorsuch eases through Senate hearings. What happened? Judge Neil Gorsuch emerged largely unscathed from Senate hearings on his Supreme Court nomination this week after dodging most of the pointed questions from Democrats still seething over the Republicans' refusal to consider President Obama's nominee for the vacant seat last year. In an assured, often folksy performance in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee, the 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals judge from Colorado stressed his judicial impartiality and said he would never be swayed by political pressure. He insisted he would have no qualms about standing up to President Donald Trump. No man is above the law, he said, and responded to a question about Trump's recent attacks on federal judges by saying he found any such criticism disheartening and demoralizing. Gorsuch, a consistently conservative judge, refused to offer his views on landmark Supreme Court rulings on issues including Second Amendment rights, abortion, and campaign finance. But Gorsuch assured senators that he had given no promises on how I'd rule in any case to anyone. Several Democrats accused Gorsuch of consistently favoring businesses at the expense of workers, including a case in which he sided with a company that fired a trucker for abandoning his broken-down rig in freezing temperatures. Senator Al Franken called their opinion absurd, but Gorsuch said there were plenty of cases where I've ruled for the little guy as well as the big guy. Democrats also used the hearings to criticize Republicans for refusing for 10 months to consider Judge Merrick Garland, President Obama's nominee. Within hours of Justice Antonin Scalia's death last February, the GOP said it wouldn't hold a vote on a replacement until after the election. Your nomination, Senator Dick Durbin told Gorsuch, is part of a Republican strategy to capture our judicial branch of government. A committee vote is expected on April 3rd, and the nomination will then go to a full Senate floor vote. Republicans, who control the Senate 52-48, lack the 60-vote filibuster-proof majority required to confirm Supreme Court nominees. But the GOP leadership has promised that if Democrats try to block Gorsuch's nomination, they will change Senate rules to eliminate the filibuster for Supreme Court nominees, as Democrats did for lower court judicial appointments in 2013. Gorsuch will be confirmed, said Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. I just can't tell you exactly how that will happen yet. Well, the editorial said, Democratic opposition to Gorsuch's nomination is just political theater, said the Wall Street Journal. Their only real attack line was that Gorsuch had ruled in favor of big companies. So what? Nearly 90% of Gorsuch's labor and employment cases were unanimous decisions. And besides, good judges make their rulings based on the rule of law, not which side is bigger or richer. This is a mainstream judge with a stellar record, and he deserves to be confirmed. Under other circumstances, Gorsuch would be a legitimate nominee, said the New York Times, but he is only in this position because of Republicans' outrageous and unprecedented blockade of Merrick Garland. By refusing to even meet Garland, let alone give a hearing or a vote, Senate Republicans upended the norm that a sitting president chooses a replacement when a Supreme Court vacancy arises. The GOP's reward for this cynical exercise in pure power, the chance to confirm a 49-year-old judge with Scalia-like conservative views who will be driving decisions into the middle of the 21st century. What the columnist said, can we dismiss this canard that Republicans stole a Supreme Court seat? Said Dan McLaughlin in NationalReview.com. Before last year, four presidents had put forward a Supreme Court nominee during their final year in office to an opposition-controlled Senate, and on three of those four occasions, the nomination process was delayed until after Election Day. Is that partisan behavior? Yes, but the GOP acted in accordance with the dominant Senate tradition. Gorsuch is being hailed by conservatives as an originalist in the same mold as Scalia, said Noah Feldman in Bloomberg.com. But this high-sounding judicial philosophy, which holds that the Constitution should be interpreted only as its writers meant it at the time, is nonsense. Much of that document's wording is vague and antiquated. What does well-regulated militia mean in modern terms? And how does it govern the sale of assault weapons? James Madison, the Constitution's lead architect, later said the general will of the nation should determine its interpretation. Democrats simply have no basis to reject Gorsuch, said Jennifer Rubin in WashingtonPost.com. He has been endorsed by both liberal and conservative judicial colleagues and showed throughout his confirmation hearings that he is an eminently qualified, temperamentally impressive individual. Democrats should swallow their pride, lick their wounds, and support his nomination. The reason this nomination is so politically fraught, said Brian Leiter in the Washington Post, is that Supreme Court justices are not impartial arbiters of laws and facts. The country's highest court has essentially become a super legislature with the power to strike down laws based on its members' own moral and political values. That's why Republicans were so desperate to keep the seat vacant until after Election Day, and why Democrats were so infuriated. It's time we acknowledged the power these unelected officials wield and had an honest hearings about the moral and political views of the nominees. Controversy of the week, Trump's budget, fulfilling his promises. So much for that return to greatness, said Eugene Robinson in the Washington Post. If the budget plan President Trump released last week is any guide, his new goal is to make the nation dumber, dirtier, hungrier, and sicker. Predictably titled America First, this brutal document calls for a 9% boost in annual defense spending, paid for with deep cuts to almost everything else. Trump is proposing a staggering 31% cut in funding to the Environmental Protection Agency and a 28% cut to the State Department, and would also deeply slash funding for foreign aid, medical and scientific research, and anti-poverty programs that provide free meals to school children and the elderly. Trump would entirely eliminate funding for National Public Radio, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and the National Endowment for the Arts, thus sticking it to those fancy-dancy elites that Trump and his supporters so despise. The good news, said Michael Cohen in the Boston Globe, is that Trump's dystopian budget is going nowhere. Congress, the Senate in particular, will never approve such cataclysmic cuts to popular programs, but this is a useful document nonetheless. It tells us everything we need to know about the cruel, heartless man sitting in the Oval Office. Spending cuts are always painful, said Ed Rogers in WashingtonPost.com. But what choice do we have when every man, woman, and child in the nation is currently on the hook for $166,000 of our $19 trillion national debt? The reality is that we just can't afford to keep spending at the rate we are. Trump's budget is a gutsy document, said Stephen Moore in Spectator.org. He wants to surgically remove trillions of dollars of wasteful spending, knowing it will make him a target of the hordes of special interest groups that populate Washington. The pushback from those groups, the welfare state, and the liberal media has already begun, but fiscal conservatives couldn't be more pleased. What cuts, said Nick Gillespie in Reason.com. Yes, this budget takes a hacksaw, if not a chainsaw, to various federal departments. But overall federal spending will still come in around $4 trillion, roughly the same as in President Obama's last budget plan, and with nearly the same deficit, $559 billion. Worse, for those of us who actually care about our spiraling national debt, Trump's budget does nothing to curb spending on Medicare, Social Security, and the other entitlement programs, which everyone knows are where the real money is. Trump promised during his campaign to completely wipe out the national debt, but he hasn't even really thrown a good first punch. The goal of this budget is not to wipe out the deficit, said WashingtonExaminer.com in an editorial. Nor is Trump saying that medical research is a bad thing, or that children should go hungry. He's just establishing the conservative principle that some activities are better handled by the private sector, or by a level of government closer to the individual. That's giving Trump far too much credit for having a guiding philosophy, said Doyle McManus in LATimes.com. This hastily written budget is just a list of cuts to programs Trump doesn't like, with plenty of funding for ones that he does, including $2 billion to start building his unnecessary border wall. With Congress in Republican hands, Trump has a golden opportunity to downsize federal spending and make it more efficient. This incoherent budget, however, would suggest that it's an opportunity Trump is determined to miss. In our good week, bad week shorts, we have that it was a good week for natural remedies after European researchers found that people who live near trees and green spaces are happier, healthier, and less likely to be dependent on antidepressants. We all need nature in our lives, said the group that commissioned the study. It was a good week for the odor of submission. After a perfume for women who admire Russian President Vladimir Putin went on sale in Moscow. Russia, as woman, is standing behind her leader, said the head of the fragrance company. This was the idea that inspired the creators. And it was a good week for Stephen Hawking after the cosmologist announced he plans to realize his dream of traveling into space by getting a ride aboard a Virgin Galactic flight. I thought no one would take me, Hawking said, but Richard Branson has offered me a seat. But it was a bad week for being haunted after researchers at the University of Michigan found that 80% of college students experience phantom buzzing on their cell phones, prompting them to check their device even though no one is calling or texting. It was a bad week for token memories after the makers of Monopoly announced they were replacing the Top Hat, Wheelbarrow, and Thimble tokens with a T-Rex, Penguin, and Rubber Ducky, following an international poll. The next generation of tokens clearly represents the interests of our fans around the world, said the company president. And it was a bad week for Hiring American after Eric Trump's Trump Winery applied for permission to hire 29 more foreign workers to plant vines and pick grapes for $10.72 an hour at its Virginia plantation. It's difficult to find people, an attorney for the winery explained. On the briefing page, we have the article titled, "The Growing Threat from North Korea. Kim Jong-un is building a nuclear missile that can reach the U.S. Can he be stopped?" What's North Korea's goal? The tyrannical Kim dynasty has been pursuing nuclear weapons since the end of the Korean War. The current leader's father, Kim Jong-il, made the nuclear program the centerpiece of his regime's identity to rally the starving, isolated country around a nationalistic goal and to extort aid from worried Western nations. Over the past two decades, the Clinton, Bush, and Obama administrations all brokered pacts requiring Pyongyang to give up various nuclear programs in return for aid or sanctions relief. But North Korea cheated on every deal. First, it violated the 1994 agreement, freezing its development of nuclear reactors. In 2003, Pyongyang announced it had nuclear weapons. After the resulting six-party talks among the U.S., Russia, Japan, China, and North and South Korea, North Korea agreed to shut down its program in return for aid. But it reneged once again. When Kim Jong-un came to power after his father's death in 2011, the pace of tests and bomb building accelerated dramatically. The Trump administration last week ruled out another round of talks. The policy of strategic patience has ended, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson said. It is clear that a different approach is required. What has Kim been doing? Threatening his neighbors and the U.S. with nuclear destruction. Over the past 16 months, his regime has tested two nuclear bombs and more than 30 missiles. It claims the most recent bomb tests involved hydrogen devices, which are much more powerful than simple fission weapons. It's not clear that this claim is true, but the explosions were nearly twice as strong as the one that destroyed Hiroshima. Experts now estimate that North Korea has built up to 20 nuclear bombs. Just as worrisome is that Kim's regime has openly boasted it is preparing to attack other nations. It called one missile launch late last year a dry run for preemptive strikes at ports and airfields in South Korea. And this month, it launched four ballistic missiles simultaneously that fell into the sea near Japan in a test of a saturation attack to overwhelm missile defenses. It said the unit that fired those was tasked to strike the bases of the U.S. imperialist aggressor forces in Japan. Would it launch a preemptive strike? Only if Kim feels certain that North Korea is about to be attacked the way Iraq was in 2003. But Kim's primary goal is regime survival, not suicide, and he knows any nuclear attack would result in his annihilation. So the real value of his nuclear program is a form of blackmail to prevent an attack on Pyongyang. Right now, North Korea has neither a reliable intercontinental ballistic missile, ICBM, nor a nuclear device small enough to mount on one. But it appears to be working strenuously to achieve both. North Korea is on the verge of a strategic breakout, says Robert Litwack of the Wilson Center. that would enable its leadership to strike the United States with a nuclear-armed ICBM. Many analysts believe North Korea is up to its old tricks, acting belligerently to pressure us into negotiations. What North Korea wants, said Philip Coyle of the Center for Arms Control, is for us to stop threatening them and to talk with them. What about missile defense? A U.S. missile defense system known as THAAD, THAAD, due to be deployed in South Korea this year, has run into political complications. South Korean President Park Geun-hye, who clinched that deal, was removed from office this month for corruption, and her likely successor, Moon Jae-in, wants to delay deployment. He favors easing tensions with Kim. China, too, opposes THAAD. It says the array could be used against its own missiles, thus undermining the principle of mutually assured destruction. Angering China is a problem because it's the only country with significant influence over North Korea. While it long resisted U.S. pleas to cut trade with Pyongyang, it was sufficiently alarmed by the recent missile test to halt purchases of North Korean coal. If THAAD goes ahead, China could lift those sanctions because Beijing sees the U.S. response, not North Korean provocations, as the primary threat to its security, says political scientist Min-Sing Pai. Can Kim's weapons be destroyed? The U.S. and South Korea frequently war game a strike on North Korea, and Tillerson said last week that if Kim keeps ratcheting up his threats, military action would be an option. But the risks are high. North Korea's full military capabilities can't simply be bombed away. Western intelligence doesn't know where most of the regime's weapon systems are concealed, and some are hidden underground or inside mountains. But even if a preemptive strike somehow took out all the nukes, it could not immediately destroy the thousands of artillery units. North Korea could still retaliate by firing tons of shells and chemical weapons into the center of Seoul, killing hundreds of thousands of people. There is no South Korean leader, says South Korean analyst Soo Chul-suk, who thinks the first strike by the U.S. is okay. We're into the columns now. We'll start with just one from the U.S. The invisible plague of rural America. The opioid epidemic is this generation's AIDS crisis, said Andrew Sullivan. In the 1980s and 90s, those of us in the gay male subculture lived in a medieval landscape of constant disease and death, largely invisible to the larger society. The same is true of the working-class communities in rural and small-town America now ravaged by the opioid, heroin, fentanyl epidemic. The scope of the carnage is staggering. 52,000 people died of drug overdoses in 2015, even more than the peak year for AIDS, which took 51,000 lives in 1995. One tragic difference between the two crises is that while AIDS was eventually overcome by innovation by pharmaceutical companies, the opioid epidemic was created by the very same companies. Their aggressive and deceptive marketing of opioid painkillers set up millions for a terrible addiction. Effective AIDS treatments were developed only because of intense political pressure by advocacy groups such as ACT UP, which forced the rest of America to see our suffering. But today, the Trump administration is embracing a health care plan that would severely cut Medicaid funding for addiction treatment. Where, one wonders, is the ACT UP of the red states? This is from Germany. Merkel's bewildering meeting with Trump. German Chancellor Angela Merkel shone in her meeting with President Trump last week, said Franz Josef Wagner. Not that the White House visit can be called a success. During the photo op following their summit, the two clearly had no rapport. Never have I seen two people more alien or estranged. They didn't appear to interact at all. Trump was simply rude, refusing eye contact and staring into his lap like a sulky child. When a reporter called for a handshake, Merkel asked quietly, "Do you want to have a handshake?" Trump ignored her. Merkel sat back stoically, a tiny, sardonic smile on her face. The whole world praised the chancellor for her statesmanlike manner. She was ironic and cool, yet without sneering. Score one for Merkel. Trump was unprepared for forthright questioning from German reporters, said Felix Haas. Christina Dunz of Deutsche Press Agentur asked the president why he labeled media reports fake news when he himself routinely asserted things that cannot be proven. A flustered Trump sarcastically called Dunz a nice, friendly reporter. The U.S. and German press praised Dunz for her toughness, but she said she was simply asking the questions that her U.S. colleagues couldn't. In Germany, the reporters choose among themselves who will ask questions, while in the U.S., the president decides, and Trump favors friendly media. Merkel also seemed to upset Trump, said Matthew Norman in independent.co.uk. It was more than just his obvious deep-rooted phobia of mature women. His body language with Merkel was that of humiliation, suggesting that on some level, he appreciates how desperately out of his depth in such company he is. She is a scientist with a PhD, pragmatic and self-contained, the opposite of the incurious and uncontrolled Trump. Merkel seemed gloomily fascinated by his ignorance and willful duplicity, said Julian Reichelt. Trump used their press conference to repeat the false allegation that he had been wiretapped by President Obama, and joked to the chancellor, whose phones were tapped by the U.S. National Security Agency under the previous administration, that at least we have something in common. She looked stunned at the comment. Almost everything else Trump said was somewhere between false, untrue, and a lie. He claimed that German trade negotiators were doing a better job than their American opposites. In fact, negotiators from the European Union, not Germany, are now discussing a trade pact with America. Then he accused Germany of owing vast sums to the U.S. for NATO, when in fact there are no NATO dues. Each member nation has pledged to spend at least 2% of its gross domestic product on national defense by 2024. And Germany, while it spends only 1.2% today, is on track to hit that target. Merkel is now grimly aware how the most powerful man in the world has declared war on the concept of facts. And this international column from China, how they see us. Trump's China policy still unclear. China feels encouraged after the visit by U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson, said Yang Xing in the Global Times. Officials here had been alarmed by President Trump's first actions in office when he threatened a trade war and questioned the One China policy under which the U.S. recognizes the self-governing island of Taiwan as part of China. But this week in Beijing, Tillerson told President Xi Jinping that the U.S. wanted a relationship based on mutual respect and win-win cooperation, phrases that Chinese analysts say mean the Trump administration has implicitly endorsed the new model of major power relations. Under the Obama administration, the U.S. had refused to use the term mutual respect because it implied acceptance of China's definition of its core interests, including dominion over the South China Sea and free rein to do what it sees fit in restive provinces like Tibet and Xinjiang. I appreciate your comment that the China-U.S. relations relationship can only be defined by cooperation and friendship, Xi told Tillerson. The secretary's boss apparently does not agree, said the China Daily in an editorial. While Tillerson was in Asia, Trump tweeted that North Korea was behaving very badly and that Beijing had done little to help stop Kim Jong-un's regime from developing new nuclear weapons. Trump wants China, which accounts for 90% of North Korea's foreign trade, to use its economic leverage to punish Pyongyang for recent missile tests. But Washington is asking Beijing to help alleviate a U.S. security concern while simultaneously putting Beijing in harm's way. China has identified the U.S.'s THAAD anti-ballistic missile defense system as a security threat that could blunt China's own nuclear deterrent. Yet the U.S. is deploying that very system in nearby South Korea. Meanwhile, Trump is reportedly plotting a new, bigger arms sale package to Taiwan. None of that sounds like respect for China's core interest. Does Tillerson even speak for Trump? Maybe not, said Ankit Panda in the South China Morning Post. During his six-day Asian tour, Tillerson was supposed to reassure South Korea and Japan that Washington remained committed to protecting its allies. But South Korean media said the secretary cut short meetings with officials in Seoul because he was suffering from fatigue, a claim Tillerson denies. And then Tillerson's boss undercut his efforts in China by tweeting during his visit. For now, Tillerson seems like an irrelevant outsider in the Trump administration. His words carry little weight, so U.S. allies and adversaries in Asia will remain uneasy about the president's hazy plans for the region. We'll know more next month when Trump and Xi meet at the president's Mar-a-Lago estate, said Nifeng in the Global Times. Until then, nobody should panic about minor fluctuations in U.S.-China diplomacy. Time is needed for the two countries to strengthen coordination for the new type of great power relations. It's time for our in-depth article, the last word feature, titled this week, A Tale of Two Countries. The gap between America's vibrant cities and its struggling rural regions is growing, said writer Elena Simules. A close look at two Indiana communities explains why cities are flourishing and small towns are hurting. Ashley Gabbert and Dan Dark are both white Indiana residents in their early 30s, but their lives look nothing alike. Gabbert, 32, lives in Connersville, a town in one of the state's poorest counties, where she works the night shift, 10 p.m. to 6:30 a.m. for an automotive parts manufacturer. Her life now is a step up from the decade she spent working in fast food, which wasn't much of a career, she told me. Working in fast food, she frequently encountered drug users as they pulled up to the drive-in windows, needles alongside babies in the back seats of their car. Like 80% of the people in rural America, Gabbert doesn't have a bachelor's degree. Dark, 33, lives in the increasingly metropolitan city of Indianapolis, where he runs a creative consultancy doing videos and marketing work for a variety of clients. Dark, a college graduate, works when he chooses, often from his downtown home or from the coffee shops and bars springing up downtown. He loves to travel. He recently returned from Iceland and goes out to meet friends almost every night of the week. The same night Gabbert was prepping for the night shift by dropping her 11-year-old daughter off with her mother, Dark was cooking a venison stew for a meat and bourbon potluck dinner thrown by a friend. I've built my life around flexibility, he told me. In some ways, the lives of Gabbert and Dark represent the diverging fates of two parts of America in the past two decades. Half a century ago, economic opportunity and upward mobility were available to many white Americans, regardless of where they lived and what kind of education they had. They could graduate from high school and find a job at a factory and make a good wage, or graduate from college and sit behind a desk and make a slightly better wage. About 90% of kids born in the 1940s earned more than their parents did. But beginning in the 1980s, the returns on a college education started growing, and more of the benefits of economic growth started accruing only to those with an education, as those without an education saw their opportunities shrink. People with a college degree or better now earn 50% of the aggregate U.S. household income, up from 37% in 1991, while people with less than a high school degree earn 5%, down from 12% in 1991, according to census data. This divergence in fortunes for those with and without higher education has coincided with another divergence, that between America's growing cities and its struggling rural regions. For a century leading up to 1980, poorer regions of the U.S. were catching up to richer regions in terms of wages, as an oversupply of workers in richer regions drove wages down, while an undersupply in poorer regions drove wages up. But this convergence petered out with the rise of computers. Beginning in the 1980s, as computers made certain people more productive and valuable in the labor market and made other people obsolete, wealthy regions with educated workers began to do better and better. Today, people with a college degree are more likely than they used to be to move to metropolitan regions with good jobs and other people like them. And this means both that those regions do better over time and that the return on that education is even greater. Almost half of college graduates move out of their birth states by age 30, according to Enrico Moretti, an economist at the University of California, Berkeley. Only 27% of high school graduates do. As booming cities draw and in new college-educated workers, employers seeking those workers follow, and cities continue to gain strength like magnets. This improves the prospects of everyone in the region, including those without college degrees. The working class strongholds that once prospered, meanwhile, are doing worse and worse as computers and robots replace the workers whose jobs haven't been sent overseas, and as a result, an oversupply of labor brings down wages for everyone still there. What this means is that people like Dark and Gabbert are having increasingly different experiences in America. What has been striking over the past two decades is how different the winners are becoming from the losers, said Moretti, who has studied this phenomenon. The wage gap, the human capital gap, the gap in type of employers have been growing at a fast pace. A few decades ago, Connersville was a manufacturing powerhouse, known as Little Detroit for the volume of cars and auto parts it produced. It was a key link in the Midwest's auto supply chain, and it was at one time the world's top producer of dishwashers. At its peak in 1980, Fayette County, of which Connersville is the county seat, had around 28,000 people and 12,000 manufacturing jobs. Connersville today is a small hamlet of single-family homes interspersed with boarded-up buildings, fast food restaurants, and low-cost chains like Family Dollar. Fayette County's population is now 18% smaller than it was in 1980. Its unemployment rate is 6.1%, one of the highest in Indiana. Its residents report higher numbers of poor mental health days than residents in other parts of the state, and they have among the shortest life expectancies. Like many of Indiana's more rural regions, Fayette County is facing a growing opioid epidemic. What's happened to Connersville is that the jobs came out and the heroin came in, said Rob Corbin, a former resident. This decline began in the 1980s. Dan Parker, executive director of the Economic Development Group of Connersville and Fayette County, told me, as big manufacturers started to downsize or move overseas, the last big employer, the auto parts supplier Visteon, laid off its remaining 890 employees in 2007. That closure and the ones before it had a ripple effect on other businesses, like gas stations and dry cleaners, as people in the community were thrust out of work. A lot of the mom-and-pop shops just evaporated when those corporations folded, Parker said. As big employers left, it became increasingly difficult for people to do better than their parents did. Economist go-to measure of economic mobility. Ashley Gabbert's mother worked at the Visteon plant making radiators until she got laid off when the plant closed. Gabbert has fewer options than her mother did. There are only two manufacturing firms left in Connersville, and because there are so many more workers available relative to the number of jobs, they can pay less than the big companies once did. Gabbert was lucky to find a job in manufacturing at all. Justin Williams, 24, is working at a bar where he depends on tips. He also had stints at a call center in town, which paid $9 an hour, and at a restaurant that closed down for lack of business. His mother worked for the Visteon plant, where she made $25 an hour. The money is different nowadays, he said. People who have the resources to leave depressed American towns tend to do so. Corbin, 39, wanted to stay in Connersville, where he was born and raised. He has taken a handful of college classes, though he does not have a degree, and for a few years lived in Connersville and did freelance video production from there. But as the town got more depressed, he decided he didn't want to raise his children there. Once nice neighborhoods have turned into Section 8 hubs, Corbin told me. People are just stuck in despair. Recently, when he was taking his 8-year-old son to school, Corbin saw an addict overdose. It was the last straw. He decided to leave Connersville and move to a suburb of Indianapolis. Many of the jobs being created in Indianapolis are high-paying ones in sectors like tech or medicine. The biggest employment sector is professional and technical services, in which employees make an average of $73,000. It includes firms like Salesforce, as well as pharmaceutical giant Eli Lilly and the online consumer ratings company Angie's List, both of which employ large numbers of college-educated people. These companies are an example of the growing piece of the U.S. economy that is focused on innovation and knowledge rather than on producing physical goods. After all, firms that produce only physical goods can send those jobs overseas or automate them. But that's harder to do for companies that rely on highly skilled workers to create new ideas and customized goods. In some ways, the divergence between places like Connersville and Indianapolis is a tale of the Americans who are benefiting from globalization and those getting crushed by it. Educated workers in cities produce work that requires innovation and new ideas. Work that isn't easily replicated and can't be outsourced. Less educated workers in struggling regions are competing with people and machines around the globe, and their wages are the worse for it. But the divergence is more than just between workers who benefit from globalization and those who didn't. It's also between the places that these two groups tend to live. That's because of something that economists refer to as the agglomeration economy. Companies want to locate near other innovative companies so that they can find skilled workers which in turn makes those companies even more productive. They want to be near specialized services like venture capital firms or banks that can help provide funding. This concentration of good jobs in a few hubs creates more opportunity for everyone there, not just people with college degrees. With their higher salaries, they eat out more, go shopping, spend on entertainment, and pay for services like dry cleaning, house cleaning, and child care. All of this spending creates more jobs. A city that has a lot of college grads also tends to have a different economic ecosystem, Moretti said. One worrying aspect of this trend is how the divergence will grow over time. Critics with strong industries and good jobs will attract more of the same kind of companies and a growing share of workers. Places with manufacturing jobs and other work that don't require a college education will continue to struggle. It's a process where the winners get stronger with time, Moretti said, and the losers get relatively weaker. There are not very many solutions to closing the gap between the two Americas. Although some one-time manufacturing hubs have been able to recruit new companies or find a new industry, they're in the minority. After all, there are lots of Connersvilles out there, and they're essentially competing with one another in their efforts to boost their economies. Focusing on one type of industry could be a successful strategy. Warsaw, Indiana, a relatively small town in the northern part of the state, is the orthopedic capital of America, with dozens of orthopedic device companies located there and a bustling economy as a result. Elkhart, Indiana, is the epicenter of the recreational vehicle industry, creating good jobs when the economy is doing well. Every place has to look at its comparative advantage and find a niche, says Ross DeVoe, chief research officer at the Milken Institute, an economic think tank. Still, it's going to be much more difficult for the Connersvilles of the world to find a place forward than it will be for the cities like Indianapolis. That's partly because in today's economy, people like Dan Dark have many more options than people like Ashley Gabbert do. The president has pledged to bring jobs back to our nation's Connersvilles. He may manage in a few lucky areas, but it's unrealistic to think that he can pull this off across the country. That doesn't mean anyone should give up on America's struggling regions, whose residents are going to have a harder time succeeding in today's economy. But what will help them is far from clear. This was excerpted from an article that originally appeared in TheAtlantic.com. And we're on the health and science page now. A couple of short articles here. The first, dental plaque reveals Neanderthals' secrets. Neanderthals are generally portrayed as simple-minded carnivores, but a groundbreaking new study of hominid teeth has found that some of them were dedicated vegetarians and may even have used certain plants as painkillers. Researchers analyzed DNA that had been preserved in dental plaque from three Neanderthals that lived between 42,000 and 50,000 years ago, two from El Cidron Cave in Spain and one from Spy Cave in Belgium. They found that while the hominid from the grasslands of Spy ate mostly meat, including woolly rhino and wild sheep, some of the inhabitants of the dense forest of El Cidron probably ate no meat at all, subsisting instead on moss, pine nuts, and fungi. It is very indicative of a vegetarian diet, study co-author Laura Weyrich from the University of Adelaide tells NPR.org. probably the true paleo diet. The DNA analysis also suggested that one of the El Cedron Neanderthals may have consumed poplar tree bark, which contains salicylic acid, one of the ingredients in aspirin, to treat pain from a diarrhea-inducing gut parasite and a tooth abscess. The same hominid's dental plaque also contained traces of the mold used to make penicillin. Another surprising finding was that Neanderthals had mouth bacteria that was acquired from Homo sapiens, which suggests that species were either kissing or sharing food. The discovery, Weyrich says, indicates that relations between modern humans and Neanderthals were probably much more friendly than anyone imagined. Vitamin C targets cancer. Most people take vitamin C to fend off a cold, but new research suggests it could also be a possible weapon in the fight against cancer. A team of researchers at the University of Salford in England evaluated seven substances, vitamin C, two natural products, and four experimental cancer drugs, on their ability to block the growth of cancer stem cells, which inhibit chemotherapy and help tumors spread throughout the body. They found that vitamin C did block the growth of cancer cells. In fact, it was 10 times more effective than one of the pharmaceuticals, although it was outperformed by the two experimental drugs. The finding adds to previous research indicating that high-dose vitamin C treatments could slow the growth of cancer cells in the prostate, liver, and colon. Vitamin C is cheap, natural, non-toxic, and readily available, study co-author Michael Lisanti tells ScienceDaily.com. To have it as a potential weapon in the fight against cancer would be a significant step. And we'll finish out the hour on the Talking Points page. First with an article, Travel Ban. Will Trump win in the end? President Trump's incendiary rhetoric has come back to bite him yet again, said Derek Hawkins in the Washington Post. Two federal judges last week ordered a halt to the president's revised executive order banning travel from parts of the Muslim world. The new pared-down version, which would temporarily prohibit the issuance of visas for people from six Muslim-majority countries, was designed to avoid the legal problems faced by his first travel ban. But in a blistering opinion, U.S. District Judge Derek Watson of Hawaii deemed the order a transparent and unconstitutional attempt to bar Muslim immigrants and travelers. Watson cited Trump's remarks on the campaign trail, such as Islam hates us, and his call for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the U.S. as significant and unrebutted evidence of religious animus. Another federal judge in Maryland also cited Trump's rhetoric in branding the new order a Muslim ban. The rulings were wrong and will be overturned, said Hans von Spavosky in NationalReview.com. In a stirring dissent from previous rulings filed this week, judges Jay Bybee and Alex Kaczynski of the Ninth U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals pointed out that Trump's order was well within the statutory powers of the presidency. To reject the president's authority to make national security decisions based on an interpretation of his motives, the judges said, was an absurd judicial overreach. Trump's order also makes no specific reference to religion, says Danny Savalos in CNN.com. So how can judges be so sure about the underlying discriminatory motivation? Should courts weighing cases involving Trump review everything he says before being elected? including his quotes in Page Six and the Howard Stern Show. Constitutional analysis cannot be psychoanalysis, said Alan Dershowitz in TheHill.com. If Trump's motives were the major defect in his travel ban, then an identical order by President Obama would have been constitutional. The order is constitutional or it isn't. You can't have it two ways. That's why Trump may win in the Supreme Court on First Amendment grounds, said Richard Hassan in Slate.com. The Ninth Circuit dissent suggests that citing Trump's past statements could chill campaign speech, which is just the kind of argument that Supreme Court's conservatives like, including swing Justice Anthony Kennedy. If Neil Gorsuch is confirmed, the argument will likely resonate with him too. And a couple of short notes. Norway is now the world's happiest country, according to the 2017 World Happiness Report. Denmark, Iceland, and Switzerland closely followed, based mostly on subjective evaluations of life quality by people in 155 countries. The U.S. dropped to 14th, largely because of poor social support and cohesion. In 2014, 7% of all U.S. births, about 275,000 babies, were born to parents who were in the U.S. illegally, according to the Pew Research Center. Sales of poster boards, markers, and other sign-making supplies jumped more than 30% in the week before Donald Trump's inauguration and the January 21st Women's March. That week, Americans spent an estimated $6 million on such supplies, not insignificant considering that many of the items cost a dollar or less. Downtown Detroit is undergoing gentrification. About 2,000 luxury apartments are under construction. 99% of existing apartments are being rented, and an average rental cost have climbed to $2,000 a month. The Trump administration has asked for contract proposals to build a 30-foot-high concrete wall or see-through wall at the Mexican border that is sunk 6 feet into the ground and would require at least an hour to cut through using power tools. And we'll finish up with a quote this week from Jimmy Breslin, a columnist who passed this week. Mr. Breslin says, "Don't trust a brilliant idea unless it survives the hangover." Well, with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service would like to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of the week. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. If you've got any questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. So long until next time.